Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting. Good morning. This is Faith Radio Mornings for this Cyber Monday. As if we didn't shop enough over the Black Friday weekend. Cyber Monday. Good morning. I am Paul Perreault, and good to have you along. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving break and relaxing time with the family and, you know, along with the shopping. Hopefully you've been generous, too, because the red kettles are out. Love hearing the bells as you're walking into some of the stores. And actually, kind of cool story. I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but I love stories like this. It's hard not to. You know, oftentimes you'll hear about people making a big donation, maybe dropping a gold coin or whatever. Well, down in Marshalltown, Iowa, somebody dropped a gold bar into one of the kettles in Marshalltown outside one of the Hy-Vees there. I guess it's a tradition every year somebody's doing that, but wow, what a way to start out the season for them. There'll be Salvation Army will be taking that bar, selling it to a local vendor, and put the money toward the Red Kettle campaign. And again, hope you give generously to stuff like that during the Christmas season, because it does go a long way. Well, as we get the show start off, boy, we had, again, a restful weekend, but also busy stuff happening over the weekend. We'll be covering some of the news, if you hadn't heard, over the weekend over in the Ukraine, or in the Black Sea. There was a major confrontation between Russian and Ukrainian Navy, and we'll be talking about that with Ruth Kramer this hour. She'll be joining us in about a half hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, plus second hour, too, because it's Monday. Dr. David Aikman is back in. He joins us most Mondays here on Faith Radio to be talking about world and national headlines and what it means for us, plus Brexit. They finally think over the weekend they've come up with a possible deal that the EU will agree to, so we'll be looking at that. Well, if you've been following the news the past few months, or actually a few weeks, I should say, there's a wonderful young lady I had a chance to talk to, Isabella Chow. She's a student senator at UC Berkeley, and she got into the headlines just for making a gracious but truthful stand on an issue, you know, that's big in the news, transsexual issues. And we'll be talking with her and what she's been going through and what she's hoping for in that. I had a chance to talk to her over the weekend. We'll be getting to that in just a few moments. Thanks for tuning in this morning. This is Faith Radio Mornings. Thanks again for listening to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Paul Perreault. About a month ago, Isabella Chow, a university junior and student senator at the University of California, Berkeley, did something rather controversial by abstaining from a vote on a student senate resolution against the Trump administration's plan to return the understanding of gender in Title IX to mean that meaning that it would be describing the biological gender of male and female. The backlash against her was rather intense. I was able to reach out to Isabella, who joins us right now on Faith Radio Mornings. Good morning, Isabella.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us so early. And interesting story, but before we get to what actually happened, tell us about yourself and your family upbringing.
Yes. So I'm a junior at Berkeley studying business and music. I grew up in a Christian family, but my parents were very open about, you know, allowing me to explore different worldviews and really questioning my faith. Whether that meant, you know, reading books of other religions or studying apologetics and, you know, studying the great Christian theologians, so that when I got to college, I not only had a solid faith foundation, but also knew that my parents wanted me to examine the truth and really to know the truth and, you know, identify as a Christian because I truly identified with it, not just because, you know, it was a tradition that my family had passed on to me. I am second generation Christian, actually. So they also went through the same process themselves when they became Christian, my mother in high school, my dad in college.
Okay, now they're immigrants, aren't they? You're an immigrant family, right?
Yes, my mom is from Malaysia, my dad is from Cambodia, and ethnically I'm Chinese.
Oh, okay. Well, when you went to Berkeley now, what have you been studying there?
Yeah, I'm studying business administration and music. I'm a classical pianist.
Okay. So why did you become a student senator? Why did you aspire to that?
Yeah, so my interest in government was actually sparked when I did speech and debate in high school. I was homeschooled, so there's a homeschool speech and debate league that I participated in. And when I was in Berkeley, I had heard about the student government. I kind of looked into it, and sophomore year, because I had reached out to a senator who was elected on behalf of the Christian community, I eventually became her chief of staff. And sophomore year, I also, after serving for her for several months, decided to run as the previous senator's successor. And yeah, so it was a very interesting combination of, government and faith, because the way it works at Berkeley is we're such a big school that candidates generally cater to a certain population to, lobby most of their votes from. And the Christian community at Berkeley is actually significant enough to vote in a senator every year. So I'm the third in line, or the third senator in a row to be elected primarily by the Christian community.
Okay. But to actually get elected, don't you have to be part of, I guess, a political party as well?
Yeah. So in the past, it's been rather difficult to run as an independent, but it's kind of changing. But essentially, yeah, I ran with a political party called Student Action, which runs many candidates every year.
Okay. Well, let's get to the events that happened now. Even before the actual resolution vote that came up on October 31st, you were aware of this and you knew this resolution was coming up. First off, describe the resolution as you read it, and what was your reaction before even the vote?
Yeah, so as you mentioned in the introduction, the primary bill that I had conflicts about was a bill that opposed Trump's proposed changes to Title IX, which deals with sexual assault on campuses. And one of those clauses that Trump proposed would define a person's gender as a person's biological sex. And the majority of the student Senate bill, which is, largely symbolic, actually I didn't have a problem with, because it just proposed, freedom from discrimination and freedom from harassment for all individuals, and especially LGBTQ and transgender individuals specifically. But where the bill crossed the line for me was that certain clauses asked me to promote an LGBTQ lifestyle and identity, and to promote organizations whose primary goal is to promote the LGBTQ identity and lifestyle. And for me, that's very different from, simply saying, I believe you should have legal protection as an individual, and that, your cases of sexual assault should be, considered in a fair manner.
So did you see that the resolution was actually going beyond what its intention was? It was making more of a, I won't say political statement, obviously it's a political statement, but it's trying to expound something to further, is that making sense, I guess?
Yeah. I think for me, how I saw it, was that it was just more of a fine line that Christians have to walk when it comes to, issues like the LGBTQ issue. Because as a Christian, right, I said on the Senate floor that I believe God created male and female. And I also believe that, God designed sex for marriage between a male and a female. But that doesn't mean that, just because I disagree with your sexual identity or your lifestyle, that, I automatically oppose all legal protections or, privileges for you. But it does mean that I, because of my religious convictions, am unable to fully and explicitly promote your sexual identity and lifestyle. So I think the bill was pretty straightforwardly worded, which was why, I was able to say I do support a majority of these clauses, but some of them just cross the line for, my religious beliefs.
Okay.
And how they apply to society and government today.
Now, before actually going to the meeting on October 31st, how did you handle it? Did you work with some other people to get a good response to the whole issue?
Yeah, definitely. I consulted with many Christian leaders in Berkeley regarding, you know, their advice and what they thought I should say or not say. I also have a large student staff, and I ran my, you know, prepared statements for October 31st by not just my chief of staff, but also my legislative advisors, and one of whom ran it by her sister, who does identify as LGBTQ. And I think for me that, you know, meant a lot to me because I wanted to word my statement in a way that you would speak to the community that, you know, would be affected by my vote or my, you know, abstention. So I definitely ran this bill and ran my words and, you know, my proposed, you know, vote, whether, you know, to abstain or not, or to vote for or not vote for, by multiple leaders and staffers.
We're talking to Isabella Chow here on Faith Radio Mornings. When we come back, we're going to get into more of the story about what happened after the actual vote. So stay with us. This is Faith Radio Mornings. Thanks again for joining us for Faith Radio Mornings on Faith Radio. I'm Paul Perreault, and my guest this segment is Isabella Chow, a student senator from the University of California, Berkeley, who, as we heard in the first segment, a resolution came up that the wording she could not totally agree with and because of her Christian convictions. And the actual meeting, Isabella, happened on October 31st. And what was the immediate response in that room during the meeting?
Yeah, I made my statement, and I knew that as soon as the vote was over, my political party, Student Action, had a press release ready to go out that disaffiliated with me. And also, you know, I felt like it misrepresented my beliefs and, you know, my stances. And because we had multiple meetings prior to October 31st, which, you know, ultimately led to me being voted out the night before the vote. And so that press release went out right after the vote. Another senator who was the primary sponsor of the bill also drafted her own statement, which, you know, cut and paste very specific parts of my statement. And they, both Student Action and the other senator, Teddy Lake, released their statements on social media. I didn't really think too much about it. I knew that a student newspaper would also cover it. But when I woke up the next morning, it was just astonishing to see how quickly this had spread and how many students already knew about it overnight. And it was just crazy because, you know, on Friday I was debriefing with my core team, which, you know, my chief of staff and also the student leaders of Unity in Christ, a parachurch organization here. And we're like, well, okay, it was pretty bad, but I think it's going to die down. But the next week, it just kept building up. Like, the momentum literally kept building up to the point where on Monday, there was a petition that was signed by, you know, over 1,000 people in one day calling for my resignation. And on Wednesday, November 7th, there was a protest before the meeting. And during the meeting, students came up and made public comments. Out of the 300 people that attended, there were about 100 people that made public comments and essentially just yelled on the microphone for me to resign. And I guess, like, for me personally, it was just difficult to see, you know, not just myself mischaracterized, but also the Christian community mischaracterized.
You were really, I read some of the stuff that was how you were being characterized, and they had a lot of accusations against you that weren't even part of what you said.
Yeah, essentially, because, you know, I worded my statement with, you know, what I hope was, you know, compassionate and sensitive. But essentially what happened was the LGBTQ community said, look, you're saying that you love, accept, and validate us, but yet you're disagreeing with our identities and lifestyles. So we see that as a fundamental conflict. Therefore, we're going to say your words about acceptance and love are completely worthless, and we're just going to take your words about, you know, God creating male and female and designing sexual marriage between a man and a woman and twisting that to mean you're a hater and a bigot, a transphobic and queerphobic senator. And, you know, when people don't take the effort to actually look at my statement, which I did release, or even if they did, essentially what's been going around at Berkeley is, you know, Isabella Chow and the Christian community are just bigots who hate LGBTQ individuals.
Now, you actually tried to write an op-ed for the student paper. What happened in regard to that?
I wrote an op-ed over the weekend right after the vote, and the Daily Californian rejected it because they said it was homophobic. And when I pressed them to, you know, explain what exactly was homophobic in that letter, they said, well, you link it to your original transcript on the Senate floor, which we consider to be homophobic. And essentially, you know, what I said on the Senate floor was, I love all of you guys, but yet these are my Christian beliefs, which is why I can't fully promote certain organizations on campus.
We're talking again with Isabella Chow, who's a student senator at Berkeley. And, okay, there was a lot of fallout. Now, you're still a senator, aren't you?
I am.
You haven't resigned, so congratulations on that. But what have you sensed in all of this? What have you sensed God doing in the midst of all of what you've gone through?
Yeah, that's a good question. What I have told the Christian community in our subsequent meetings and prayer meetings about this is that I really pray that there are two things that we take to heart from everything that's happened. One, I hope that the church continues to dialogue even more about the LGBTQ issue. We don't have to agree theologically and practically 100% about, you know, where we lie theologically, but we do need to talk, right? And I especially say to Christians who may hold different theological or practical views, like, I need to talk to you. Because you disagree with me, I need to know your perspective and hear your opinions, right? And it's not a time for us to just go back to our echo chambers or back to our churches where everybody sees eye to eye. The second thing that I really pray is happening is that we wrestle with what it means as a church to love and to outreach to the LGBTQ community. Because actually on November 7th during the protest, what a lot of people went up to the mic and said, I mean, of course, you know, beyond the F words and the hurtful slurs, were a lot of them had very traumatic stories about how they were isolated and very hurt by the church, you know. And I think we as a church have to acknowledge that we don't fully wrestle with the LGBTQ issue enough. And, you know, we have ignored this community for too long. I don't have the answers for what it looks like to, you know, outreach to this community, but I do know that whatever happens, we need to dialogue with each other, and we need to dialogue outwardly to speak the truth and to speak the truth in love.
Well, I'm sure you've been enjoying this break from all the political stuff at Berkeley, because I'm talking to you while you're at home right now with your family for Thanksgiving, but what are you expecting in the few days ahead here as you get back to school?
You know, honestly, I'm not sure. Because the weekend after the vote, we were so confident that everything had ended that it was just, you know, a week of intense drama. But it's pretty much dragged on for a month now. I'm not too confident that students will actually make all the effort to call a recall election for me. And I'm also asking, you know, supporters to be careful about what they're doing because, you know, obviously I can't really control what people who support me do. And that does include some people who want to be more public with, you know, counter protests or public demonstrations. And for me, like, that just doesn't really feel like, you know, the right mode right now. I don't think that the church needs to do a counter protest to justify ourselves. I think that we need to, you know, tangibly serve the LGBTQ community while wrestling with solidifying what we believe and solidifying how we articulate our beliefs in a way that, you know, is understood as much as possible by the community here.
Okay. One more question for you, Isabella. And for those listening, it's a call to prayer, I guess, for them. And so what would you ask them to pray for you?
Yeah. You know, honestly, like more than prayers for myself, I'm going to ask for prayers for the church in Berkeley. For years, people have prayed for increased unity in the church in Berkeley because we have many solid fellowships and churches, but we rarely work together just because, you know, we function as independent fellowships and churches. But what I have seen over the past month is, you know, a beginnings of an answer to prayer where churches are starting to talk to each other and churches are starting to realize, like, it's not just one church or one senator that is attacked. It's the entire church that needs to rise up and respond in a time like this. Right. So, yeah, prayers for unity in the church, and secondly, prayers for the Berkeley campus, because, you know, at the end of the day, human arguments are not going to change minds. It's the Holy Spirit that will change hearts and minds and bring them to see the light of the gospel. And I will say what needs to be said, but it's the Holy Spirit that has to work on our campus, and that's really all that we can pray for.
Wow. Isabella, that's so well said, and I can personally say for myself, quite impressed. So thank you for all you're doing there, for your standing boldly, faithful, and lovingly. I can add that. I mean, it sounds like you're trying to be loving as well as truthful. So kudos to you. So thank you for joining us this morning on Faith Radio Mornings.
Thank you so much.
Ken Davis is next. Again, thank you for tuning in to Faith Radio Mornings on this Monday. And again, thank you for listening this morning to Faith Radio Mornings, 31 past the hour. And of course, today, Cyber Monday, touted as the biggest online shopping day of the year. E-retailers are estimated to rake in more than $7 billion in sales today, a jump of 17% over last year. But that's also on top of a record online Black Friday, where Americans spent about $6.22 billion in online sales. This wasn't in-store sales. This was online, a record high. That was a jump of almost 24% from last year. The sales are being driven by the purchase of big-ticket items on by shoppers' cell phones, shopping on their cell phones, including buying cell phones. Wait. So people on their smartphones buying their next smartphone. Doesn't that seem like betrayal? Anyway, this is Faith Radio Mornings. Twenty-four before the hour, this is Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Paul Perreault, filling in for Peter Kapsner, who should be back on Thursday, enjoying an extended Thanksgiving break. Well, last week we had a chance to talk with Justin Gimity from the AND campaign, talking about criminal justice reform, which is before Congress again. And he says it really is something we as Christians should be thinking about.
I think Christians should always be concerned about criminal justice because the Bible is full of false imprisonment and all those kind of things. And it's a human dignity issue. If we're really about family, we should want people with their families. And that is not to say that people shouldn't serve the time for the crime they committed. That's not what this is about. But we always have to be conscious and making sure that the punishment fits the crime.
Right.
That's something we should always check on. And really, that's what this does. Tries to make sure that the punishment fits the crime. It also gives some money for job training, rehabilitation, things of that matter. All things that Christians should really think hard about because we believe in redemption. We don't give up on people. And if we can give people a second chance and be merciful, then we should. Again, this has nothing to do with putting people back on the streets who shouldn't be on the streets. But we should always be looking for a chance to give people second chances when we have the opportunity.
If you'd like to hear that full interview with Justin Gibney, it's from our Tuesday podcast last week. So just go to myfaithradio.com and under shows, find Faith Radio Mornings, and you'll find the podcast there. Ruth Kramer is up next from Mission Network News. Good to have her back because we missed her a couple of weeks ago, but a lot to talk about, so we'll be with her in 1 minute.
If your goal is a blessed life, loving God's Word is the key. This is Jim Garland. How many of us are guilty of failing to really engage with the Word of God? We passively read it, and then we promptly forget it. Or we disengage from a Sunday sermon by Monday. We're supposed to meditate on the Bible. It's something we wrestle with, ponder about, and search for understanding in. It should be interwoven in our hearts to the point that our actions are habitually guarded by it. You see, we need guardrails to keep us from veering off the road. The Bible is our ultimate guardrail. But as you mature in your Christian walk and become well-versed in Scripture, you won't be bumping into the rails much. The Word will become a part of your very being. So dig into that Bible and receive its many blessings. I have more to say at jimgarlow.com.
No one has gone before.
21 before the hour, and the Trekkie in me rejoices every time we have Ruth Kramer on, because I get to hear that. Hey, thanks, Ruth.
No problem. It's one of my favorites. It makes me smile every time.
Well, how's your Thanksgiving?
It was busy. It was, I need some time off from my time off.
I bet. Now, you were before that. I saw you. You actually texted me about, you know, the fact that you're trying to get back into training because you, along with being the reporter and anchor person for Mission Network News, you also are a award-winning track star, and you're trying to get back into training, and that came right before Thanksgiving. So.
Yeah, well, my training partner is actually one of the kids I was coaching on the high school varsity team, and she's started to run on the college level. She came back for a break and asked me if I would join her for a workout, and then brought one of their top sprinters with her.
So
that's what I was doing the day before Thanksgiving, and so pretty much the next two or three days, I was kind of stiff.
I can imagine. And then you had to go into the kitchen. You had the family over. Hey, at least a warm kitchen with the turkey cooking and then the humidity from making the mashed potatoes. Hopefully it was kind of like a sauna, you know.
You know, it was just kind of one of those things. We have a tradition in our family where we join another family for Thanksgiving, and they host it. So we were over at somebody else's house where it was warm in their kitchen, and it was a great time. It was relaxing on that end. I had an extra five people in my house that don't normally live there, so it was just a little chaotic on our end, but it was nice and relaxing for Thanksgiving Day. And then it's just, you know, everybody needing to do different things and get places and do schedules, families, and it was kind of a mayhem and chaos until I dropped them off at the airport.
Well, hopefully it was an overall relaxing weekend for you, but stuff happened over the weekend, including over in the Ukraine, or actually Crimea area. Tensions were ratcheted up between Russia and Ukraine. Russian warships captured several Navy vessels of the Ukrainian Navy near the Crimean Peninsula in the Black Sea. And, you know, this is just added tensions in that area. Now, this is something that some of your partners in that area have been concerned about for a while. Can you explain that?
Yeah, let's take a step back here and talk a little bit about what's at stake. You have the two countries, Russia and Ukraine, kind of meeting, loggerheads is a good way to describe it. You had a pro-Moscow government in Ukraine that lost control of its power 4 years ago in an election, and that touched off a lot of protest from the pro-Russian side of Ukraine, people who wanted to stay closer in touch with Mother Russia. And what wound up happening as a result of that is Russia annexed part of Ukraine, the Crimean area and the peninsula that goes with that, and that touched off a war in the eastern side of the country, which involves the pro-Russian forces, the separatist forces, and Ukrainian forces that are trying to just get control of that whole border area. At stake in between there, you've got the Sea of Azov, and you have the Black Sea, and there's the peninsula in between that connects the two areas, and it's the water rights and some of those things that that they're fighting over. And in this situation, this specific situation with the standoff between Russia and Ukraine, it supposedly happened in international waters. Of course, one is saying it happened in international waters, the other is saying, no, you actually crossed over, and that was not legal. There is a bilateral treaty that grants both countries the right to use the sea if you can get through the strait. So you can see where things are starting to happen. It sort of sounds like a game of Risk here at this point. Both countries calling for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. The president of Ukraine is actually asking for permission to implement martial law for the next 60 days because he's basically saying it's possible Russia is going to be more aggressive. I need the power to do what I can to protect the country. We have national security at stake here. So it's already ugly, and now it seems like it's gone up another step. Everyone in the European Union and in the international community is asking people to kind of stand down because we don't need this to exacerbate already difficult situations there.
Any idea who, if like Putin is behind this, or was there any direct orders or anything to that that you've heard of?
It's Russia.
Good point. Point made.
So Our partners, Slavic Gospel Association, have had a long history in Ukraine, and especially in the eastern area where you've had some very difficult situations hitting a lot of their church partnerships and the pastors and things like that. They created, in response to all the difficulties and the refugee situation, an evangelistic fund, and it's an emergency evangelistic fund to come alongside churches so they can buy supplies and what they need to help the people who are seeking shelter in the church doors. Over the years, since this has been going on for like 4 years now, the fund started out really strong, and it was helping the churches to provide emergency supplies for food and medicine and water, and in some cases shelter. But then over the summer, this summer, that fund ran dangerously low because people quit giving to it because people are no longer paying attention to this situation. Mm-hmm. Because you've had so many other situations occurring around the world that people are starting to look at that. And in the North America context, if you open a news page, this situation is not going to be on the front page. It is now because of the standoff. But in the past, you know, as even though there's been ongoing conflict there, this situation has not been on the front page. The Syrian refugee situation has fallen off the front page. And you've seen a lot of other things that have been more closely related to U.S. politics. So this just kind of highlights this ongoing conflict, the difficulties that are faced there. The body of Christ in Ukraine has been very strong in standing together and trying to provide help and in giving hope in a situation that feels very hopeless to the folks who've survived the ongoing conflict. So it's just it is an issue of prayer. They're asking for prayer that obviously the hostilities would cease, that there could be a supernatural covering of an agreement so that peace or non-hostile situations would result. But in the between times, the churches are opening their doors and they are sharing what they have as resources, feeding people who've lost everything. Right now, there you have a lot of farm area that has been completely devastated. So it's going to be an ongoing thing even after hostilities cease. You know, there's no crops. Okay. So you're looking at a long-standing crisis.
Yeah. We're talking with Ruth Kramer from Mission Network News. And when we come back, she referenced Syria and the refugee situation. We're going to be talking about that and the needs there. So thanks again for listening to Faith Radio Mornings. Faith Radio Mornings for this Monday after Thanksgiving. I'm Paul Perreault, still filling in for Peter Kapsner. Ruth Kramer from Mission Network News is my guest. And Ruth, a couple of weeks ago, you usually join us every 2 weeks, but 2 weeks ago you were on a road trip to Beirut, Lebanon. And I'm sure it wasn't just for the cuisine. Tell us about your trip.
Well, I was really privileged to be hosted by a number of our partners in Lebanon. One of the things that is on everybody's minds in Lebanon is the situation with the Syrian refugees. Now, if you look at a UNHCR report with the official numbers, you're talking about a country of 4 million people hosting about 20 to 30% Syrian refugees, and that's actually more if you include Palestinian population, the Iraqi refugees, the Afghanistan refugees. So, you know, when you talk to people on the ground, and we're looking at it separately from UNHCR, we're talking to ministries who have their hands deeply embedded in the refugee crisis and answering those needs. They're saying the refugee population overall in Lebanon is almost 40%.
Wow.
In that 40%, 30% are actually Syrian refugees. So you're talking about a crisis that is enormous. It's a huge, I can't think of the term right now that would make it sound any better, but it's a huge drain on Lebanon's resources. And so Lebanon is really struggling to handle this because it's the country that hosts the largest number of refugees relative to its national population. You know, they are going other places, but Lebanon and Syria share a border. So
right.
It's really easy to get into Lebanon to get away from the fighting, and that's why you had so many landing in the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon. So one of the things we got to do with the visits that we were making out there was to make a trip out to the Bekaa Valley and visit some of the refugee camps. and just see where things are, especially because an agreement has just been put into place. And I say just, it's a relative term within the last couple of months, between Syria and Lebanon to get the refugees back home. And that seemed like it was a good thing on the surface. But as we were talking to some of these Syrian refugee families in the camps, they were very reluctant to go back home.
What was the reason for the reluctance?
It varies. Some of them are saying, well, there's still fighting way up in the north of Syria. And until there is no fighting in Syria, we don't want to go back home because the risk is that violence will spread. And that's how it happened the first time. You had violence in the north and then it just trickled all the way down to the south until the whole country was involved. Keeping in mind that in this particular fight that has been going on for 8 years, there are probably, an estimate is at 180 different organizations and groups that are fighting for control and dominance of Syria. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to be a clean sweep of get everybody out. There are really no good guys. There's no overall bad guys. Everybody's just kind of in their own thing for dominance of Syria. And so if there's any fighting still going on, people are afraid to go back home because they're afraid it's going to start all over again.
And I was reading one of your articles and there was concern about, okay, we go back, they could be conscripted to fight.
Yes. And that's another issue. A number of families fled as they saw things coming down and they made the decisions, we're just going to leave the home and take what we can and head down to the border and get over the mountains. And they have a lot of young men with them. And because they fled, they thought they would be arrested for deserting, for not, you know, answering the national call to join the military. And then Syria issued kind of an overall document that would basically pardon anybody that they would have ordinarily considered deserters, hoping that people would come back home. And the young people are still saying, yeah, but because there's fighting in the north, and you could still conscript us, force us to fight in the military. And that window for the military is age 17 to 45.
Ah, big window.
So it's a big window. And so the young men don't want to go back home because they're afraid they're going to be forced into service. Even, you know, regardless of how they felt about the politics of it, that's what their main concern is, because they've known people, they've had relatives or friends that have tried to go back and then got conscripted or got arrested and put in jail. And so they're afraid to go back home for that reason. There's another reason that they're afraid to go back home, and that is there is no infrastructure. If you look at some of the towns that they left, it's just shelled out hulls of buildings. And they're looking at that saying, okay, well, that's my house and it's sort of still standing, but I'm not sure I want to live there because it's now at a multiple angles of instability. And it's probably not safe to live there. But even if we could find a place to shelter for a while, there's no services, there's no electricity, there's no running water, there's no hospital working, there's no schools, there's no jobs. So there's no infrastructure there. And so some of the ministries that have been working with the refugee population in Lebanon are crossing the border and trying to lay down some foundational stuff to create those infrastructure network support services that kind of bridge the gap, so that people that are working with these ministries in Lebanon, who are being serviced by these ministries in Lebanon, will feel more comfortable at going back home because the same organization is there trying to help them, you know, start to rebuild. But that's such a small drop in the huge bucket of need. It's an obvious point, but there's just not very many because these ministries have been spread so thin for 8 years. And then you've got this situation where you listen to the heartbreak of a parent saying, I just want my kid to have what I had growing up. Usually what you hear with parents talking about their kids is, I want them to be able to do better than what I did. And now they're looking at the situation and saying, there isn't even hope for that. Not hope for a future, barely hope for anything. I want them to be able to have what I knew as a child, to be able to be free and be able to have a childhood, and that's been stolen. A lot of the issue is that the kids have come out of Syria and they can't go to school because Lebanon doesn't allow them to go to school. They won't register the kids. They have no statehood. Their proof of statehood is back in Syria, and all of those buildings have been destroyed, so the records have been destroyed. It's a very difficult situation. So ministries, again, have been trying to step in and kind of bridge the gap there by creating schools and trying to bring the kids up to speed. And the issue again is that Syrian kids are not at the same level of education as the Lebanese kids.
Right.
When you go to Lebanon school, a school in Lebanon, you're taught in English, French, and Arabic, and high math and high science. Syrian kids are coming in, all they speak is Arabic, but the school instruction often takes place in all three languages. So they're already dealing with a language barrier, and it's been kind of difficult. So the schools that are doing it well are trying to bring in all of these other aspects of education. And then when you get to 12 and 13 years old, because of the needs of the families that are in Lebanon now, as the refugee families, they need those kids to start working,
okay,
to be domestic service or farming or whatever. And it's been very hard for them because a lot of them just give up their education because they have to support the family.
Right. We're talking with Ruth Kramer, and we have to wrap up here. Ruth, real quickly, though, I would point people to your website, MNN Online. There was an article you had. We don't have the time to talk about it, but I urge people to read the article you have talking about Heart for Lebanon's. You talk to them, and the word reconciliation kept coming up, and how they're applying the gospel is just amazing. But Ruth, thanks for joining us this morning here on Faith Radio Mornings, and hope to talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Don't forget, tomorrow's Giving Tuesday.
Yes. Real quickly, I'll give you 30 seconds on that one. I mean, a lot of ministries on your website worthy of Giving Tuesday.
Yeah. So, you know, what we do is we provide you an opportunity to look at ministries that we know are doing good work on the field. And Giving Tuesday is a good way to come alongside organizations that are doing the work on the field when you can't go. So pray, give, and go.
Okay. That's a good idea. Ruth Kramer from Mission Network News, thank you again for joining us here on Faith Radio Mornings.
Thanks for having us.
Well, maybe one of the Bible verses you memorized was dealing with anxiety. Be anxious in nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication, make your requests known to God. What happens when your body is fighting you on that? We'll be talking with Linda Mintel shortly about that here on Faith. Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.